Lord be with you. Hear the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Glory to you, O Lord. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." This is the gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ.
May I speak in the name of God, source of all goodness, truth, and beauty. Amen. Please sit down. Well, as I say, I find this an enormously encouraging feast day. When you're trying to follow a life of faith, follow a certain kind of life, follow a set of values which are not easy to follow, it's enormously encouraging to feel you're not alone. And in a sense, that's why we gather together week by week, to feel I'm not the only one trying to live this life. But today, of all days, with a sense that people who've gone before us and people will come after us, and there are people around us who we don't even know who are seeking to be faithful to these values, this kind of life, however much it costs them, is enormously encouraging in my mind. And to imagine them all with us, with the angels and all the rest, just joining in our worship and goading us on and encouraging us, come on, everybody, you're the ones who are seeking to live it now. I find that just a lovely, lovely image, and to get caught up with that. But you could say, well, what life? And what values are we being invited to live by, or have these saints lived by? And this is why every All Saints Day we have the same reading, Matthew's Beatitudes, as if these are the values that these saints have lived by in the face of suffering and persecution and even death. These are the values that they've been tried to be faithful to. And these are the values that are therefore held up before us. And Matthew, of course, has Jesus right at the start of his gospel, right at the start of Jesus' ministry. These are almost the very first words that Jesus says in the very first of the very beginning of the first of his five sermons, as it were, in Matthew's gospel. These are the words offered to us as Jesus goes up Moses-like up a mountain, not to receive the Ten Commandments, but to give to us seven values. I say seven, you may have counted eight. The last one isn't a value, the last one is a consequence, persecution. We'll come on to that. So it's as if Matthew and Jesus are saying, this is it. This is the heart of what it's all about. This is what I come to share with you and to give you. Everything else is perhaps outworking of that or how to engage with that. But this is the heart. This is the election manifesto. This is what I stand by. Judge me by these. And of course, in our ordinary time green booklets, we read two or three of them out at the beginning of every service. And the rubric says, and deliberately, leave a pause after each one, as Joan did today, so that they sink in, so that we can reflect, blessed are the merciful. What does that mean for my life? Have I shown mercy this week? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. In what way have I done that? How have I shaped my life around these values that are right at the heart of the Jesus Manifesto for us? Well, I want to say three things, of course. I mean, it would be silly for me to work through them all. So I've got three things to say about the nature of these Beatitudes. And I can only apologize, they don't all begin with the same letter. Two of them do, but you can't always do it, can you? So they seem to me, quite importantly, countercultural values. So they're not the values of our mainstream society. Mainstream society, we get caught up into the pursuit of wealth, power, and fame. Not all those are wrong, but the pursuit of them will misalign our life, if that's what we aim for. And yet that is what is going on all around us. And I don't mean just, you know, look at the young of today. It's easy to say that. What we probably all need to look at is look at the group of people who are around me. What are the values they live by? And am I getting swept along with them without really thinking? What do people spend their time on? What do people read? What do people spend their money on? What do they watch on TV? What do they talk about? There's much goodness in the world, but there's much that's just getting caught up with a completely different set of values, which were not Jesus's values. To what extent am I just caught up unquestioningly with the values of the people around me? I think all we're asked to do is think, is this what I'm called to be as a Christian? How does it match up to the Beatitudes right at the heart of his manifesto for us? And there's no excuse in just saying, well, it's the culture. We're seeing this in the whole series of sex scandals going on in every walk of life. People are saying, well, it's just the culture. You get caught up in a culture. We will be held to account for following a culture unquestioningly in different ways. Let us think much more deeply. This may be the culture, but is it right? Secondly, perhaps because they're countercultural, they're costly. You're not going to get rewards for being the meekest person in the class, for showing mercy. Sometimes maybe, but on the whole, on X Factor, it's not the merciful one who gets the prize. And if you really hunger and thirst after righteousness, you're going to get up a lot of people's noses. It's not going to be popular what that might call you to speak out against power on behalf of those who are most in need. It will not make us popular. We will not get the rewards that perhaps we long for. It will cost us. And of course, this is what's put right at the end, where Jesus says in the last, you will be persecuted for this. You will be persecuted. But there's perhaps a deeper reward, which I'll come back to towards the end. But thirdly, and for me most interestingly, these set of values are not religious. If you go through the values, the rewards might have religious language, but the values themselves, mercy, meekness, seeking after righteousness, there's nothing religious in them. There's nothing about how you get saved. There's nothing about a particular set of religious practices or beliefs. You could say these are human values that cut across religion and could be shared by all humanity. It's a manifesto for human flourishing. And I find this really interesting to reflect on. Because, of course, the truth is there are problems with religion. Religion can be an enormously supportive structure to support people in helping to live out certain values. But in another sense, and so often, it can get in the way of human flourishing when it drifts towards its tribalism, where we find our identity just with one group rather than being a member of the human race. It gets in the way of what we're seeking for in world peace, bringing humans together for human and for the flourishing of the whole planet. So there are problems with religion. And you might be aware of there's been quite a lot in the news recently of what some people call the fastest growing religion in the Western world. And that is not Islam, as it happens. It's a group of people who identify with the phrase spiritual but not religious. And generally in censuses, you get about 40% ticking the box religious, 60% ticking non-religious, but only 9% of those, or 9 to 15, will be hardened atheists. Many are saying, I relate to the word spiritual, but it's religion I have a struggle with. And many are good people. Many are better people than you and I. These are good people. And it's really interesting to explore what is the issue, what's going on here. And on the whole, they react against religion for three key reasons. One, they react against hierarchy, by which they feel excluded from power. And I find this personally very difficult. I'm part of the hierarchy of our hierarchical institution, and I find that quite conflicting. I've tried to reflect at times, how do I do that? How do I fill that role without wielding power? And I haven't always got that right, and other people will tell me, I've often not got that right, depending on your perspective. But a very difficult one to do, and I feel conflicted with it. Especially having become area dean, I've experienced being excluded from power and have experienced what that feels like. The second thing people in this group react against is dogma, the feeling of being told what to believe. And I and others in this church have tried to work very hard, in this church particularly, for an open-minded, reflective, exploratory way of exploring faith. So no one's telling you what to believe, but let's think together. Let's explore this path towards truth. But nevertheless, I'm a representative of an institution which lays down dogma and requires us to use creeds, which we actually don't all that often use the full creed. But nevertheless, they're there. That's part of our setup. And again, this is quite a conflicting position to be in. The third thing this group of people react against is any form of exclusivism. Any way one human is excluded from the institution just because of who they are. And of course, we too have tried to work to be an inclusive church in different ways. There are many ways we are not inclusive in this church, and we're trying to raise a bit of consciousness and awareness and explore how we can be more inclusive, but at least where it's on the agenda and it's something where we're working at. But nevertheless, I am a representative of a wider institution which is exclusive, sometimes in unconscious, unaware ways, sometimes in fully conscious, institutionalized and structural ways. And I find this deeply, deeply conflicting. Very difficult position to hold. And you may feel, well, it's okay, we can work away at it in our local church, but that doesn't seem to be enough. There was a young woman who came to church not that long ago, and I think it's okay to share this story because she's disappeared, and this was quite a while ago, not to be seen again. She came in, and I do my normal thing, say, oh, are you visiting? And, you know, how was it? And how did you experience church? She said, no, I thought it was lovely, but I'm not sure what my partner would feel. And I said, your partner is? And she said, a woman. And I said, well, I think you'll find a warm welcome in this congregation. I think you'll find people are welcoming and caring, and that won't be an issue. And she said, and tears were coming to her eyes at this point, but the headlines, and her voice was cracking up, and she just rushed away. I saw her once more to try and encourage her, but it was too much. So it's not enough even to be working on it in a local church. It's something about the wider institution to which we belong, which is a problem. What are we doing about that, might be a question. To engage with the issue that many people have. And it's not just sexuality in terms of exclusivism, it's educational background. How do people cope with the amount of words we cram into one service and intellectual ideas we assume are understood? It's about belief, you know, the set of creeds we require to be at the center of the service, the people who feel excluded because I can't get my intellectual head around that way of understanding reality. There are different ways we, as a wider institution, we're required to build this into our worship. That is a deeply difficult thing to be part of. And perhaps we can reflect on that and say, well, what are we doing about these things? But the Beatitudes cut across all of that. There's no hierarchy built into the Beatitudes. There's no requirement to believe set dogma built into the Beatitudes. And there's no exclusivism, in fact, exactly the opposite in the Beatitudes. It's an inclusive agenda. And you might even suggest, perhaps Jesus wasn't so religious after all. Yes, he lived with the religious norms of his day. He probably went and said the prayers and knew the Psalms. But the heart of his agenda is an agenda for humanity, for human flourishing, something that all humans could engage with and learn to love. It seems to be forms of our religion that do the dividing and the splitting and the working against peace. And it's a deep, deep challenge for us who are involved in the religious game. The bishop is wanting us to reflect on the Beatitudes all through the diocese to think about what these might mean for us as a church. So I've given you a few, I hope, quite challenging thoughts. He's trying to ask the question, what kind of church should we be? And his answer is, we need to be a Christ-like church. Perhaps fairly obvious, but what does that mean? And he's saying, look at the Beatitudes. That's what a Christ-like church should be. That's what we should be forming our communities around and our lives around. He's got three words that, of course, all begin with the same letter, but they're quite useful to remember, and you may have heard them. These, for him, summarize what the Beatitudes are about. Contemplative. He wants us to be a contemplative church, thinking profoundly, deeply about these matters. He wants us to be a compassionate church, a church that feels people's pain, especially perhaps those who feel themselves to be excluded by our religious structures. And he wants us to be a courageous church, a church that is willing to take risks for the values we believe in. Good words. Interestingly, none of them religious. Could be shared by anyone from any religious background or even non-religious background. Fantastic words to reflect on. But just finally, rewards. Every beatitude begins with, blessed are those. Blessed are those. And at the end of the beatitude, there is the supposed reward if you've lived like this. So if I keep these beatitudes, will all go well for me? Well, in a word, no. Because all these rewards are in the future. All of them are, this will happen. The theologians will use one of their words, eschatological. These words are linked with when the revolution happens, when the tables are turned, when Jesus comes again, when the kingdom comes, these are the people who will be held up as the heroes. For now, they won't be. They will be ignored, they'll be persecuted, they will not get the things some other people in our society seem to have. So, how can I encourage you? I hope this thing will encourage you as it encourages me. When I find life most difficult, perhaps involved in controversy or just things are not going well or not going right, if I, to the extent I can feel, if this is true, that I'm in the right place, trying to do the right things, I can feel okay. If that is true, and sometimes I'm not quite sure, but if I can feel I'm here in the right place and I'm trying to do the right things, then even if things aren't working out or if it's very painful, I can feel okay about it. So it might be this: if you are trying to base your life around these values, day by day reflecting on them and wondering, how can I live these out? How can I live them out personally? How can I live them out within my local church? And how can I challenge my wider church to get with this agenda? Then even if it is painful, even if things don't go well for me, even if I'm ignored, even if I'm persecuted, I know I'm in the right place, and I know I'm trying to do the right things, and I know I am blessed.